From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, filling in this week for your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Muslims are increasingly being targeted here in this country.
An unprecedented increase in the number of attacks, both against property and against the Muslim community.
Every Muslim is a terrorist.
I better wake up and smell the falafel.
Interreligious relations can be challenging enough on their own. But when things are inflamed for political purposes, even more damage can be done. In the aftermath of 4 years of anti-Muslim fear-mongering on the highest levels, religious liberty attorney Asma Uddin has put together a compelling book titled The Politics of Vulnerability: How to Heal Muslim-Christian Relations in a Post-Christian America. It's due out next month from Pegasus Books, and you'll meet the author on this week's State of Belief.
So the research I do shows that religious freedom is good for the economy, good for society, and good for business.
What would it mean if religious diversity, equity, and inclusion were a core value of the workplace? What if the hijacking of the language of religious liberty by the political religious right could be countered by the verifiable advantages of institutionalized respect and equality? Working to answer those questions is the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, and on this week's show, you'll hear from Foundation President Dr. Brian Grimm.
Well, thank you all. Dr. Fauci, thanks for your leadership. Thanks for being here. 2 weeks ago, I spent some time with you and Dr. Francis Collins. You gave me a tour of the Vaccine Research Center in Bethesda, Maryland. The brilliant team there made possible the rapid deployment and development of COVID-19 vaccines, and they're truly remarkable.
Exposing just how showbiz-oriented much of our national media has become, the Biden administration may be having some trouble exciting reporters. But calm competency returning to our nation's capital is a development worth noting. Later in the hour, I'll talk with political management expert Greg LaBelle about normalcy's return to Washington and whether he thinks it can last. This year, State of Belief is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcasts from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. So much of that work has been possible thanks to the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. And now to our first guest. Asma Uddin is a religious liberty attorney, activist, and author of the upcoming book entitled The Politics of Vulnerability: How to Heal Muslim-Christian Relations in a Post-Christian America, Today's Threat to Religion and Religious Freedom. Asma, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Jack. I'm happy to be here.
You state very clearly in this book, as well as your previous one, When Islam is Not a Religion, that the power of faith is often harnessed for ulterior motives, often ones that those most affected are unable to see. Where does this core insight come from for you?
Well, I've been in the religious freedom space, advocating both domestically and internationally, engaging in litigation, extensive public speaking, writing, you name it, from all the different angles, for over a decade now. And so when I write about the problems that I see in the way that religious freedom is perceived and talked about and advocated, I'm really rooting it in all these years of just sort of being at the very core of the religious freedom battle in this country. I mean, I've had the opportunity to work on cases that are talked about at the national level and that are impacting the way that Americans across the nation are understanding religious freedom. So it's really just those experiences and also specifically experiencing those things as a religious minority and even more particularly a member of a pretty, widely despised minority in the U.S. I mean, I think the Trump era was interesting in its focus on evangelicals, but, you know, preceding that and throughout all that, and currently Muslims are definitely put under the microscope. And so to be sort of a member of a group that is looked at with so much suspicion and often hatred and fear, and then also, you know, and which is fundamentally not an ethnic or racial group, but also a religious group that has its own claims to religious freedom. And just the way that the religious freedom discourse as it's heating up in this nation, but then very clearly sort of creating lines so that the advocacy for religious freedom is not seen as beneficial to this, to Muslims, essentially, gives me a unique insight.
Maybe you could give us a couple of examples, and not necessarily specifically from Islam, because I think it's very important that you find these tendencies among the followers of some very different religious traditions.
Well, I mean, I think that much of what we saw during the Trump era is a classic example of that. It's something that I talk about in my forthcoming book, The Politics of Vulnerability, where I acknowledge that there's genuine vulnerability among many, for example, white Christians, white conservative Christians, in a very quickly and dramatically changing America. I mean, the landscape of America, both racially and religiously, is changing, and with it have come significant cultural shifts. And that's leading, quite understandably, to a feeling of being under siege, to a lot of sort of anxiety on the part of white conservative America, that white conservative Christian America, that for a long time sort of saw America as reflecting their beliefs, right? That was a dominant sort of like influence on culture and politics. And, you know, given those shifts, there's been a positioning of, you know, of Christianity, of white Protestantism and religious freedom as oftentimes a shield or a way of protecting the things that they see as being under threat. So on the one hand, I absolutely acknowledge these things as human tendencies, right? So I use the word vulnerability very intentionally because I'm not saying these people are somehow different from other humans. I think it's something that all humans would feel. I think it's very natural. But when I say that the politics of vulnerability, I'm concerned about the way that it's politicized and the way that these feelings of vulnerability are then used to essentially create an us versus them dynamic, to define and to look at religion and religious freedom as a way of protecting one's own interests and quite explicitly as a way of hurting or limiting other people's interests. So it's really just that dynamic that we see in the U.S., but not just in the U.S. I mean, lots of people looking at the rise of populism in a number of European states have observed the same phenomenon.
So am I correct in understanding that you're suggesting that this fear of displacement, whether it's rational or not, and this sense that that privilege may be revoked is what motivates lots of people in religious and ethnic groups to misuse their own teachings to promote their particular interests?
Right. I mean, it certainly incentivizes that in the sort of use of religion. And again, in this context, religious freedom as well, like the language and the law of religious freedom to sort of think about their in-group interests. My forthcoming book really positions this in the literature and the studies around group identity and intergroup bias. And there's a lot there if you just sort of dig into it. And I think few people have applied it to the context of our politicized religious freedom discourse in the U.S. I don't think actually anyone has. That's my contribution to be like, well, what are these sort of basic facts about social psychology and the way that this intergroup sort of hostility is manifested and the causes of these things? And I'm like, this is exactly what's going on. And it was something that I had observed just, again, in my experience being at the center of all of this. And then when I started looking at this literature, I was like, this is exactly what I've observed. And I think it needs to be parsed. And I think not just in terms of explaining the problem, but also in terms of finding solutions.
So will you, just to be very blatant about it, describe what you mean by the politics of vulnerability?
Well, it's specifically this that way where vulnerability, again, as a natural human emotion or feeling which, as you noted, a part of it might be rational, part of it might not be, part of it might be justified, part of it might not be. But the fact is that it's being felt. And what I talk about in the book is actually a line that I take from Ezra Klein, that to the extent that a loss of privilege feels like oppression, he writes, if you don't treat it as such, if you sort of respond to it with feelings, with sort of response of like animosity or sort of to mock it, right, mockery, then you sort of create the opening for demagogues and reactionaries to seize that vulnerability and weaponize it. And again, it was something that before I ever read, you know, what Ezra had to say about this, he was talking just about polarization generally. He didn't actually write, or he doesn't speak much about religious polarization, which is like the sort of gap in the discourse, where people who are sort of looking at the causes of the polarization aren't really looking into these sort of religious dynamics. And again, that was my contribution. But I saw that very specifically with respect to a number of groups, but being an American Muslim and being very much rooted in the space of religion, I saw this example and I was like, well, why don't I write a book where it explains this in action when it comes to Muslims? And so lots of scholars looking at Islamophobia or anti-Muslim sentiment have seen, for example, the statements put out by various conservative, like media personalities, politicians, the ways that many of these talking points are taken directly from what the Center for American Progress calls Fear Inc., a billion-dollar industry that kind of sort of funds a number of these agitators, these anti-Muslim agitators, who essentially pump out policy proposals and talking points that position Muslims as a sort of mortal threat to Americans. And just sort of like, what is, you know, the fact that they have something to seize on, like, what is that thing that they're seizing on, right? What is the opening that we give reactionaries and demagogues, conspiracy theorists, and how do we sort of close that opportunity? How do we just sort of cut off the source and say, if we can just sort of address the root causes of vulnerability, maybe then these guys, these reactionaries will have less to seize on.
So do you put more hope in religion or in psychology to unravel and heal some of these toxic tendencies toward polarization and division?
I would say both. I think, you know, one thing I say in the book is that, we can talk about different forms of polarization, right? Political polarization, for that matter, polarization on the basis of ethnicity and race and so on. But what makes religious polarization different, at least in my mind, is that we're dealing with religion here. And religion, no matter what the religion is, pushes us as humans sort of rise above the fray, to focus more on altruism, to think about things like the ultimate purpose of our lives, to have guidance from outside ourselves. So often in today's culture, we have a sense of certainty that we just know the answers, and whoever disagrees with us is often not just wrong, but fundamentally evil, and therefore not worthy of conversation. And I say, well, I'm pretty sure all of our religions, and certainly my religion, says something very different. It says that you should be engaging with others with civility and with an eye toward who these people are as people and in their full complex selves. And as it turns out, a lot of what our religion says is also what a lot of social psychologists are saying today about how to sort of help ease a lot of this sort of these culture wars or sort of these ideological battles. I quote a lot from Brené Brown, who's very, very famous, who essentially built an empire out of explaining and helping people understand vulnerability. And so much of what she says, I mean, the same principles are very much repeated by many of our religious texts. And so I would say, you know, religion as I think many of us believe that it's divinely revealed that God, who created us, knows how we think and how we understand other people. And religion is absolutely intrinsically then tied to our social psychology.
You know, one of the words that's been used in discussing these issues, and wildly overused at that, is the word hate. You don't shy away from identifying some religiously instigated attitudes and beliefs as hateful. As an attorney, which you are and I'm not, I'm sure you've given a lot of thought about how and where one can draw that line of distinction. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about vulnerability, about fear, about very human tendencies and reactions. But hate, you know, specifically as something that then is manifested in violence, for example, boundaries that the law draws, right? In terms of, okay, these are what you're feeling, but now you've sort of implemented that and allow it to be expressed through actions. And so certainly that, and also the extent to which these attitudes are manifested in various policy proposals, which is really the focus of my first book, which came out in 2019, which was titled When Islam is Not a Religion, Inside America's Fight for Religious Freedom. And that title, When Islam is Not a Religion, was inspired by first a very explicit argument that was made in the context of a mosque construction matter where the Islamic Center in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, was challenged when it set out to construct its mosque. And actually challenged in court, and the attorney argued quite explicitly that Muslims and Islam and this mosque were not protected by the Religious Land Use Act because Islam is not a religion, he said. It's something else. It's a nefarious political ideology, and by the very act of creating this building in which people can pray and white kids can play basketball outside and go swimming in the swimming pool, this is going to pose, again, a mortal threat to America. And so this idea of Islam is not a religion, while it was said explicitly in that case and less explicitly in many other cases, I mean, that's what I traced in that book, like this idea of turning Islam into something not religion in an effort to strip American Muslims of their constitutional rights is at the core of so many other things that American Muslims are facing. And so certainly in terms of the law, when you begin to look at these sort of policy proposals, these very sort of concrete strategic attempts to limit the constitutional rights of one particular religious community, that's where it draws the line. Whether it's hate crimes and violence or these sort of legal proposals, that's certainly the point at which it needs to be looked at beyond the question of people's emotions and social psychology to something that needs to be dealt with differently.
So I'm going to ask you a really unfair question, because every author spends thousands of hours in research and formulation, hundreds and hundreds of hours in writing, and produces a whole unit, a book. But what's the one thing that you hope that every reader comes away with from reading your book?
So I think the thrust of both books, and I think more explicitly with the second one, is that we can talk about these problems. We can talk about these very real threats coming from one group against another, but that conversation can be constructive. And it doesn't mean that the people who are thinking or feeling or acting even in really sort of problematic ways need to be sort of outside the pale in terms of our being able to converse with them and to see them as humans who, you know, have legitimate human emotions. Now, I think when it comes into the course of like actual violence, I think, again, there's a line drawing, but I think there's often a conflation between the few who engage in physical acts of violence and the many others with whom they share a certain characteristic. And absolutely, as an American Muslim, I can tell you that, you know, my community and me individually have been victim of that. Whereas if it's, you know, crazy people who are self-described Muslims engaging in acts of violence, my entire community has to bear that burden. And so I can't really spend all this time and energy to explain to other people why that's wrong, but then turn around and do it to another group. And so therefore, I do look at the differences between, again, the sort of the violent actor, who absolutely needs to be treated as a category of itself, and then the people with whom, you know, they share some sort of belief. And I think, of course, it's a widespread problem in terms of some of these feelings of under siege that, you know, led to people supporting Trump and going along with a number of things that many of us think are unacceptable. But at the end of the day, the way to solve that problem is not to keep sort of shutting these people out and putting them, again, beyond sort of like the scope or the ability to be able to converse with them and to see them as humans. One thing that my book is very focused on is looking at the practical impact. Like, if you're really concerned about changing things, here's how to do it. And the way to do it is not to treat these people as inherently evil or evil, period. It's to see them as humans and try to figure out where they're coming from and listen to them a little bit more authentically instead of with so much scorn. And it seems to me, based on the empirical studies, that that's going to be far more effective in getting these people to understand what you're thinking and how you're feeling than if you just shut them out.
It's a powerful message, and all the more so because you've been able to document it. The book is entitled The Politics of Vulnerability, How to Heal Muslim-Christian Relations in a Post-Christian America, Today's Threat to Religion and Religious Freedom. It's a long title and an ambitious project, and Asmat Uddin, when the book comes out on March 23rd from Pegasus Books, I hope lots of people will pick it up and read it. You're making an important contribution to an essential conversation, and Asma, I can't thank you enough for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Jack. Thank you for having me.
We're just getting started on this week's show. Up next, the head of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, Brian Grimm. And later, in Praise of Normalcy, political management expert Greg LaBelle will be back with us. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. There are good reasons why freedom of religion at work is a phrase that sets off alarm bells for many of us. The elevation of a certain kind of conservative political Christianity has been elevated to untouchable status in the service of American culture wars. And a victim has been the core American value of religious freedom itself. Working relentlessly to reclaim that value for all is the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, working for workplace religious diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I am pleased to welcome Foundation President Brian Grimm to State of Belief Radio. Brian, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you. And that was a nice introduction.
I wish I could say I wrote it, but... So, Brian, the language of religious freedom has been effectively hijacked by the religious right in this country. And it feels like we need to start this conversation with a definition of what exactly it is that we're talking about. So what is your definition of religious freedom?
Well, I have three. I don't know which one you want. Maybe I'll weave them all in. But sort of at the fundamental nature, I see religious freedom as something that sets people of faith free to do good. That's not a definition that many people talk about, but I think that that's behind why religious freedom is an important right, because people of faith organize charities and all kinds of activities that do good. And I think religious freedom, you know, guards that space in society. But the sort of the bigger definition comes from Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where it's coupled with freedom of conscience, belief, and religion. And so those are intertwined. So it's, in short, it's the ability to have a faith, change your faith, or have no faith at all. So, you know, atheists are just as much included in religious freedom protections as are people of faith when you put it in that broader umbrella. So I think that that's how I approach religious freedom, that it's, you know, something that's there for protection for everyone, and everyone can benefit from it. And I think, as you said in the introduction, it's important that Americans, and not just Americans, but the world come together around this, what I consider a very positive human right.
And what's the third definition?
Well, I think that the third definition is, you know, within the U.S. context. And when I think of the workplace, there's two things. One is that within the workplace, there shouldn't be any discrimination based on religion or belief, either in hiring, firing, promotion, job assignments, et cetera. And there should also be accommodation, a reasonable accommodation of people's beliefs and their actions in the workplace. So I think that's a sort of more technical definition when it comes to our workplace, but it's one that I think is important. And corporate America is coming around to embracing that more fully.
Well, let's talk for a minute about corporate America. How did you get started in this massive work of advocacy for people of all faiths and no faith in business and the workplace?
Well, I have a long history. I can go way back to I worked in China for many years. I worked in the Soviet Union for many years and in the Middle East for many years. And one of the going back to the Soviet days, I was working in Kazakhstan, and the Soviet Union was dissolved in my NGO's office building. Boris Yeltsin and all these guys showed up, and I was living in the prime minister's compound, working with the government on different initiatives as an NGO. And then all these guys showed up one night in our compound. The next morning, they came down to my office building. We had a big round table, and they ended the Soviet Union. And then the next week, the new now president, instead of first party secretary of now Kazakhstan, as a Kazakhstan country instead of a Kazakh Soviet Socialist Republic, asked if I would help them turn their Communist Party training school into a business school. Which we did, and working together with Coalition of People. And so right at the start of a new country, the new president saw that there was some connection between faith and freedom and, you know, business. And so, you know, I've sort of been working in this space, you know, for some years, but I really got into it more directly after I had worked at the Pew Research Center for about 8 years, developed an index that measures restriction on religious freedom around the world, and then saw where you have fewer restrictions, you have more human rights in general, but you also have more sustainable economies, and you have a bundle of rights, even progressive rights like LGBTQ plus protections, where, you know, we find that where you have more religious freedom, you have more LGBT plus acceptance. It doesn't mean the two are causally connected, but the correlation is quite, you know, interesting that they move in the same direction. So once you measure something, then, you know, as a person of faith, there's a whole book in the Bible called Numbers. And so those numbers sort of motivated me. And I saw it as a calling to step out and start this foundation more than seven years ago to focus specifically on this topic.
If you'd pick the book of Judges, you'd be working on our judicial system, I imagine.
There's all kinds of professions in the Bible.
The functional definition of religious freedom that you subscribe to, that you drew from the UN Declaration of Universal Human Rights, talks about faith as something that is internal. It is conscience, it's belief, it's religion. Yet the conflicts in the public arena tend to be through practice. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so I mean, in that Article 18, it also talks about being able to celebrate and practice these beliefs and religions alone and in community and teach them to your children. So there is a public aspect to that. And that's where the rub sometimes comes. It's when a certain faith teaches one thing and society's heading in a different direction, and you want to call them back and say, you know, thus says the Lord, as they might say, you know, that we shouldn't do that, or we should do this. So I think that one of the issues that often comes up is that people they hang religious freedom just on one or two hooks. So, you know, it's like, well, religious freedom means this, and we want politics to support this. So I think that that's what it's a reductionist view towards religion, that it's only this one issue. So full disclosure, I'm a Catholic convert. So after my time in the Soviet Union, I was Baptist at the time, became Catholic. And that's a whole story in itself. But one of the things that I find very appealing about Catholicism is the Catholic social teaching. And there's, you know, if you look at the social teaching, there's 30, 40 different things that come out of Catholic faith and the scriptures that Catholics focus on: poverty, the environment, all these other things. So I think part of what's important about religious freedom is realizing that faith groups don't just have one issue that they focus on, but there's many. And so sort of getting that, even that pluralistic approach of faith into the public square, I think would be really important. And that's what I see happening in corporations. They're not focusing on those issues that might divide us, but instead having people be able to, you know, share the fullness of their faith in that context. And so that's where I see religious freedom flourishing.
My guest is Brian Grimm, president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. I said right at the beginning that one of our greatest concerns has been the ever narrower application of religious freedom as a concept that protects only one religious faith, a concept that has been deployed in the American culture wars with great success. So how do you make sure that that distinction is protected, that religious freedom in the public square is always a shield and never a sword?
One of the things I do, I can just give an example, is to make sure that we include everybody, or, I mean, that's a big thing, include everybody, but include people that have a stake in this, all the as many players as we can. So we just had a large national conference where we had head of diversity for Google as a keynote. We had 11 vice presidents of Fortune 500 companies speak about religious inclusion in the workplace, from Texas Instruments, Intel, PayPal, and many other companies. So at that conference, we invited Debbie Allen, who's the executive director of the Secular Coalition for America. And she's an atheist, she's a humanist, she's a non-theist, she's warm towards religion. She sees that faith has done a lot of good things in the people that she knows and loves. And so she's not anti-religion. But does she get invited to religious freedom things very often? You know, that's not who you first think of would come to such an event. And so I think that's what we need to do. We need to, who else is interested in religious freedom? And let's all bring all those people together. And it worked beautifully. You know, she shared from her heart, and we had a beautiful discussion. So I think that's part of it, is to not, you know, not just be with people like ourselves, you know, and then that expands this out much further than just, you know, one or two issues.
To really be intentional about it.
Yes.
So, Brian, in addition to advocacy, I know that you do a lot of very valuable research. Would you talk for a minute about how different industries compare in terms of religious freedom? You've mentioned a few companies, but are there industries that are better at this than others?
Well, it works across all industries. I'll begin there and then get to which ones seem to be doing better. But just three big Fortune 500 companies, Tyson Foods, they're in meat manufacturing, and, you know, they have plants, and, you know, it's real hands-on work. American Airlines, they're moving people around the world, you know, in airplanes, less than they used to, but that's what their job is. And then Intel and Texas Instruments and companies like that, you know, they're working on software design and coding and, you know, things, Google, you know, it's all technology. So all of these companies have excellent programs in terms of religious inclusion. Tyson Foods has chaplains at over 100 chaplains on staff, serving the needs of all people of faith and of no faith. And it's just like Karen Diefendorf, their head of chaplain, says, you know, people's problems don't end once they walk through the factory door. You know, whatever's going on back home, whether it's a sick relative or someone died or a divorce or a move or whatever, all those things affect people. And that's what the chaplains are there to help with. And then American Airlines, they have a chaplain who's also a chief flight controller. And they also have employee groups for different faiths and helping. But the tech companies in particular in recent years have really understood why this is important. I'll give an example. And I won't name the company that the person came from, but the one that he went to. So a guy in Silicon Valley, top engineer, you know, somebody you don't want to lose, wanted to pray, you know, and have his meetings in the company's schedule around his prayer times. He's Muslim. And the company said, well, no, we're not going to start doing that. And then another company down the road, Salesforce, which has a employee group called Faithforce. And he said, hey, I hear you guys are open to people like me. And they said, sure, come on over. Well, you don't have to lose too many top talent, too much top talent before you say, whoa, this is not a feel good issue. This is a bottom line business issue. So because the tech companies deal with, more intellectual property, you could say, accommodating that, one, you'll retain people more, but two, they want inspiration. Everybody sort of knows Google stories of different ways they try to motivate people to have the next big idea. Well, if you're made to check your faith at the door when you come in, then you're leaving what might be your inspiration outside, and then you're sort of working like you got to hide who you really are. So the companies have seen that this, is not really good for business. In fact, it's good for business to be open and inclusive. So I think the tech companies are leading in this. I mean, there might be other reasons, but I think those are some of the main ones. And I think others will follow, because where your big companies go, I think eventually, most companies will also go there too.
How have the attitudes that you've been tracking changed over the last couple of decades?
So this year we released an index. This was the second year we did it, on measuring the religious diversity, equity, and inclusion within corporate America. In the index this year, Intel has taken the top spot. And one of the reasons is because they have a variety of religious employee groups, and they're adding others. They have one for atheists, agnostics, Christians, Muslims, Jews, and others. This year, they added one for Baha'i. Now, of course, you're familiar with Baha'i, but it's one of the smallest world religions. But Intel, one of the largest, most successful companies, said, well, you're just as important as the other bigger religions. You can have your group too. And so they stood that up, and they got points on the index for that. So it's, just interesting how recognition of one of the smallest religions by one of the biggest companies gave them a high score on this index. And so I think that that's part of what's changing in America, is that people recognize that we are more diverse country religiously. I know that there's, with the politics and all of that, that there's been some backlash against that. But within corporate America, within many segments of society, that's seen as a good thing. And so that's the change that I'm seeing, is that when a small group like the Baha'i all of a sudden help a big company become successful, that's a story. And I think when those stories get out of people of different faiths helping other people or helping our society in general, then I think we're going to move toward a more acceptance of this pluralism that we're in. At least that's what I'm hoping. And I think corporate America is leading the way. That's why I'm hopeful.
Brian, earlier this month, the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation concluded its Faith at Work conference. What do we need to know about that?
Well, I mentioned one thing. We had the Secular Coalition for America there. We had representatives of Black churches there who are also in business. We had big corporations with multi-faith in involvement. And I'll just give one from Intel. They had a panel talking about we need to have greater sensitivity and thicker skin. And that was the title of their panel. And they had, and it's not a joke, but they had, the head of the Jewish group, the Muslim group, and the Christian group, the three of them got on, and they're all best buddies. And Hadi Sharifi, he's the head of their Muslim group, originally from Iran. And in his sharing, he said, I didn't ever know anything about Baha'i until May Montzumi, who's heading now their Baha'i group, started to tell me about it. And of course, in Iran, Baha'is are highly persecuted. Yes. So here you see something that you couldn't ever imagine in Iran happening in the workplace in America. And then one of the stories that Hadi shared was recently Intel, they've gone through a leadership transition. The old CEO's leaving. They're bringing in a new CEO because of business issues. But he talked about it and he said, you know, that was so emotional for me because, you know, when our old CEO was giving his farewell address, I just broke down and cried. This is a guy with a PhD in, you know, whatever kind of engineering he does. And he said, why would I cry? When he said, well, the reason is I have this interfaith friendship with my Christian brother and my, you know, my Jewish brother. And next year we're all going to go to Jerusalem and we can travel again and get some great hummus. You know, it's all about the food. And isn't that a beautiful just story of what happens when you open these relationships within the workplace? So the theme of the conference was authenticity and connection. And every panel touched on that in one way or another, talking about why when you open your door, as Hadi said, he can bring not his whole self to work, but his whole soul to work. You know, what boss doesn't want that? You know, we want that kind of commitment, but they earn the commitment because of their recognition that this is an important area for people. So we also had the general counsel for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission speak and sort of laid out, you know, here's what it means to cross the line and religious discrimination, but here's what it means to do more with religious accommodation. And, you know, we just had such a wealth of different kinds of talks. And we also had sessions on faith, technology, and artificial intelligence. The chief ethicist for Microsoft joined in the discussions with faith-based ethicists. So I saw it as truly a watershed conference. We had one the year before where people came in person, but this year, because it was virtual, you know, like I mentioned, we had 11 vice presidents of Fortune 500 companies participate. You know, most of them prepared their videos ahead of time. But, you know, they all wanted to speak into what's going on.
If our listeners want to see some of these sessions, are they available online?
They are. It is still the conference platforms there, and they're all on demand. There's a fee to register, but we're going to release them bit by bit over time on the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation's website. And the short name for that is faithandbusiness.org, faithandbusiness.org. And the talk we've released this week is the keynote by the head of diversity for Google, who's by background Jewish from Argentina. And that played heavily into why he saw the importance of bringing faith into their diversity and inclusion at Google.
So I'm guessing that by visiting that website, our listeners can also learn more about the work of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation and how to get involved.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're not as much of an organization as we are a movement. So, you know, we love to connect with people, network with people who are interested in this and you know, build out this this momentum of what we think is a, you know, a more civil society.
So remind us of the website again.
faithandbusiness.org.
Great. Dr. Brian Grimm is president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, working for workplace religious diversity, equity, and inclusion. Brian, it is a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Jack. Great to be here.
Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Jack Moline, sitting in for Welton Gaddy this week. In recent years, we've gotten far too accustomed to describing every administration action as unprecedented. Along the way, our conversation partner has often been Greg LaBelle, political management expert and veteran of several presidential campaigns. To make sure we don't gloss over the importance of the return to competence we're seeing in the nation's capital, I'm happy to welcome Greg back to State of Belief Radio. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jack. It's nice to see you again.
You too. You too. I fully recognize enormous challenges are in place for anyone who wants to lead this country. But is it fair to say normalcy has returned to our nation's capital with surprising speed?
No. there are intense efforts to make that happen, but I think that what we are witnessing, particularly up on the Hill, is an ongoing debate, an ongoing fight among numbers of sort of factions. We have these two major factions within the Republican Party, the Trump wing, which oddly enough, or maybe not oddly enough, still exists, and those in party leadership who are trying to break away from that. And that is spilling over into the debate about bipartisanship that President Biden started with his inaugural address and his efforts at bipartisanship. So, no, I don't think anything has been resolved yet. I was on a Zoom call last night with, among other people, Adam Kinzinger, who is one of the most vocal sort of people in the "let's stop talking about Donald Trump" wing of the party. You know, he said this part of the conversation, he says, "I've already got somebody running against me in my reelection campaign." So now this whole thing is by no means resolved.
I'd love to get your take on the moves the Biden-Harris administration has taken thus far, not just on this subject of bipartisanship, but in general.
Well, again, this is one of those interesting things that we sort of get wrapped around the axle on everything, because, as I said, the president in his inaugural address and in other statements since the election has talked about bipartisanship and working together and unity and so on and so forth. And then the question becomes, well, what is unity? How do we define unity? And it seems that that has become a cottage industry in Washington, with Republicans saying, well, unity means we get to tell you what to do. And if you don't agree with it, you're not living up to your commitment to unity. So there's a real effort, I think, but at the same time, this administration has taken on some very serious issues, not the least of which, obviously, is the COVID-19 situation, which we've seen very little done by the previous administration, and they're really trying to make up time. So this administration has to make some decisions. Are we going to wait to try to get Republicans on board with some of the things we want to do, or are we just going to do them? And I think that President Biden learned, as vice president with the ACA, that waiting created more problems than it was probably worth to bring Republicans, to think they could bring Republicans on board, who never came on board eventually anyway. And so I think their decision is, we've got to do this. And so they've made that decision, it seems, to move ahead and do it. And that's before we even get into the whole issue of nominees for cabinet positions.
Yeah, let's talk about nominees. It seems the wheels are turning again, but there's still an awful lot of sneaky acting appointments to sort out, as I understand it. Is that right?
Oh, leftovers. Yes. The Trump folks made a real effort to implant some of their folks in positions. Now, a number of them can be removed, and the Biden administration has been doing that. And in fact, just this week, President Biden appointed three new members of the Postal Commission, which is an important step for those of us who really want to see Mr. DeJoy find a new job, preferably in a prison workshop. The bigger issue, I think, is just the refusal on the part of Republicans to what I would say is play fair with regard to new nominees for cabinet and just sub-cabinet positions. And there are some who are seeing some issues around their focus on women and minorities. They seem to be the ones who are running into the most trouble. I'm a particular fan of Congresswoman Deb Haaland, who is a nominee for Secretary of Interior, first Native American to hold that position, which I think is an extremely important step in the right direction. There's some real challenges faced there. And this is the slowest process for nominees being approved, I think, in many years. And, you know, part of that was, you know, we couldn't even get an agreement on how to organize the Senate out of Mitch McConnell way back when. So that sort of slowed things down. So this is a significant and ongoing problem for the administration.
So let's talk about the slow way that this transition has taken place. Is it your sense that this was just sort of Trump-style theatrics that have spilled over into this new administration? Or is it an expression of an ongoing extreme partisanship that is threatening what used to be the more solemn aspects of a functioning democracy?
I think, Jack, that it is the latter more than the former, but maybe a little bit mix of the two. I mean, this is a point where I feel like just turned into a cranky old man and I'm going to do it. You know, I remember the days when, and I do remember the days when a new president of the Congress, whoever was over sitting on the Hill with a new president, generally, and I'd say 9 times out of 10, their response to cabinet nominees was, a new president is entitled to put together his team.
Right.
And that was the mindset. And people say, well, this one may not be perfect, but, you know, the president is entitled to put together the team that makes sense for this administration. And that's gone. That simply doesn't, that's not part of the equation anymore. And I think that's really unfortunate, because these aren't felons who are being nominated here. I mean, these are people with which members of Congress have some policy disagreements. Well, of course they're going to have policy disagreements. They belong to a different party. So that's the cranky old man in me response to that. It's a sort of, you know, why can't we just sort of do this the way we used to do it and let the president have his cabinet and let them sink or swim on their own merits instead of this? But everything seems to be now a battle for the soul of fill in the blank. And that's sort of where we find ourselves. And it's very distressing. Yeah.
People are coming to Washington now to work in this new administration. Are you observing a resurgence in young people's interest in coming to Washington for internships and to work for the federal government?
I don't know specifically about that, although it wouldn't surprise me. But what I am seeing, I have been a fan of, as you know, Jack, of the importance of young people in politics for most of my life, having been involved in two areas, primarily in electoral politics and in academia as a teacher. So I have been fortunate to be able to surround myself with young people in both in campaigns and in teaching situations for many, many years. And I'm a big fan of young people and what they can do. And I think we are seeing a real resurgence among young people in an interest in politics, which seemed to have faded for a while, even almost, I think, a fear or loathing of politics. There are new organizations sort of popping up that I have great hope for. One of them is the Millennial Action Project, which is a relatively new organization, which is focusing specifically on that millennial group in terms of reaching out to figure out how to repair our democratic processes. So there's a lot going on, and I find it extremely exciting that young people seem to have found their way back into an interest in politics. And I think it's directly related to the presidential election, and maybe even more so to the runoff elections in Georgia. Young people are feeling empowered, and I'm very, very happy about that.
Are you worried that they're going to be subsumed under this atmosphere of hyper-partisanship that you just described?
It's always possible. And I think that's one of the major things that they have to fight against. And I know that the Millennial Action Project, the one that I mentioned, I know that that's one of their concerns. They're trying to keep both sides involved and become truly bipartisan in how they approach issues. To some extent, the Interfaith Alliance has often faced challenges along those lines with sort of keeping people with disparate views involved. And it's a real challenge, and it takes a lot of work and constant alertness to the possibilities of that happening.
So let's move from Washington, D.C. to Orlando, Florida for a minute. This weekend, the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, was featuring former President Donald Trump. Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
He's going to be one of their speakers. Do you expect he'll try some wild stunt to regain the media attention that he's got to be sorely missing right now?
I don't think he needs to. I say that with some sadness. I think the fact that he's going to be speaking at CPAC is going to be enough to draw the media's attention. They will report it on it in what some shape or form. I expect what we will see is the same old whining about the witch hunt, about I didn't lose the election, I actually won the election in a landslide. We may see the same old litany of grievances that seems to be where he's stuck. He will undoubtedly make some allusions to how he will run strong candidates against anyone in the Congress who dared to stand up to him in the recent impeachment process. What I'm hoping is that this is the last. He will get attention for this speech because CPAC always gets attention. It's sort of the nature of this thing. But I'm hoping that once that speech comes and goes, that we can really try to forget about him and let him do whatever it is he needs to or can do, and we can go on with our lives.
I think it's so important not to prematurely say mission accomplished. That didn't work out so well once before.
Right.
How dangerous do you think covert resistance and hostility to the new administration may be, both inside the government and beyond?
Again, I think that the opposition to the current administration, to the government as it exists now, is built in to the Trumpies, to what they're about. I think that's a given. And I think that we will continue to see that along the way. As I said, I think we're seeing it to some extent in the reactions of some members of Congress to some of these cabinet position nominees now. That will continue. The hopeful sign I see is that Joe Biden, and as you know, early on, I was not a Joe Biden supporter during the primary. But I recognize and applaud his capability, and I'm glad that he's where he is, because with the years of experience that that he has behind him, I think he is able to navigate this better than maybe almost anyone as president at this particular time. So I'm encouraged by that. He recognizes the value for most of us in not waking up every morning and wondering what the president said before I woke up this morning or after I went to bed last night. And I think that there's a lot of support for a presidency like that right now. But that takes some time to sort of shake out. So I think the administration is taking the right approach. We've got work to do. We've got policy to talk about, and that's what we're going to do. And y'all just got to kind of get in line and join us on this. And I think that's sort of where they take. And he surrounded himself with some remarkable people. Jen Psaki is press secretary. It just blows me away every time I see her. Partly, of course, is the bar was so low when she stepped into the job. But even aside from that, she is remarkable in terms of the level of respect and knowledge and capability that she brings to that podium every day. And she's just one example of that.
Greg, you've worked on a number of presidential campaigns. You've taught political management over the years. In what universe do some of the former president's loudest defenders, enablers, and apologists get to go on with business as usual with no consequences for trampling the norms and standards, for putting their colleagues in mortal danger, and for betraying truth itself? Do they get away with that?
Unfortunately, you asked what universe that exists, and unfortunately, it appears to be the universe that the rest of us all share with them right now. Should they get away with it? No, of course not. Will they get away with it? I think the jury is still out on that. I think that I know that there are lots of investigations that are going on. And you touch on something that's of concern to me. And this is why I want to stop talking about Donald Trump specifically. Trump is Trump, and he's going to have his own set of problems right now, financial, legal, and everything else. But what you just said is really the key question. What do we do about all these people who enabled this and are now going to try to sort of shift the focus as they feel necessary to come across as somehow on the right side of this, however that's defined, especially the Ted Cruz's and Josh Hawley's of the world who plan to run for president as they keep their fingers up in the wind and try to figure out where they need to be on these issues. So I am cautiously optimistic that the investigations that are going on, and there are many investigations I'm sure that are going on that we don't know about, that are looking at things that that need to be looked at. And I just my hope and my fond expectation is that we will find ways to do this, because that is really one of the big challenges that we face. We hear Republicans say, well, let's just move on. You know, you want to unify. Well, let's just move on and forget. We can't forget this. I mean, the example is that's been given, and I don't think it's too far off. Is the example of South Africa with the truth with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that came about. We need to figure out what the systemic issues are here that brought us to this point, and we need to face them.
Yeah.
And that's our challenge.
Greg LaBelle is Professor Emeritus of Political Management at George Washington University, where he ran several popular academic programs. He's a veteran of several political campaigns, presidential campaigns in particular. Greg has held leadership positions at prominent organizations, first among them, Interfaith Alliance. Greg, I know things aren't going to stay calm for long, so I'm glad we could have this conversation today on State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being with us.
I'm glad too. It's nice to see you, Jack. Take care.
Before we go, it was moving to watch President Biden and Vice President Harris pay solemn tribute to the 500,000 lives lost to the pandemic in this country. 500,000 deaths is a number none of us is equipped to truly grasp. But more and more of us are being impacted personally. And this week, death came to the Interfaith Alliance family. Bishop Joseph Grabowski was an active and energetic member of our board of directors, an inspiring faith leader, and a man with boundless plans for the future. He was also a dear friend. Founder of the Institute on Religion and Public Policy, nominated several times for the Nobel Peace Prize, prolific writer, traveler, and advisor to leaders around the globe. In literally just hours, in the first part of Wednesday, Joe was stricken and then felled by the consequences of this horrific disease. He was just 46 years old. We mourn together with his wife, Tracy, family, and friends. May his memory be for a blessing. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and to be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join Welton Gaddy next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. I'm Rabbi Jack Moline. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.